Moncrief on News Talk
with the Dacia Duster. Shockingly affordable, and now with 3 months deferred payments too.
53106 is our text number. That will cost you 30 cents. You are listening to the Moncrief Show on News Talk. It is indeed time for parenting. Joanna Fortune joins us once again. Good afternoon, Joanna.
Good afternoon, Sean.
Here's your first question. My daughter is 3.5 and very clingy to mammy, me. She's also extremely hot-tempered. I'm having trouble getting to the bottom of what's causing it and what I can do to help. On being clingy, she pretends to be a baby and wants to be fed, have a bottle of milk. If she could fit into an old baby grow, she would. I have read before that if your child does this, to go with it, so I have, but it hasn't seemed to help very much. She's pretending to be a baby for over a year now. She did get a baby cousin around that time, but we don't see the cousin that often, maybe once a month. On her temper, I don't mind the temper, but I hate seeing her so upset. She doesn't tantrum for long, but she does get upset many times during the day. I also rang our public health nurse. When she heard that my daughter gets on very well at play school, is well behaved and happy going in, she recommended that we get a bit stricter at home. She could be right, but when my daughter already gets upset easily, I find it hard to be strict or firm. She finds it hard to settle to sleep at night, so tiredness is playing a part. She just wants mammy for bedtime and shouts and screams and take ages to settle if it's daddy. Surprise, daddy is stricter than me. Does some children just last a long time in the toddler tantrum stage, or do I need to be more firm so that she knows the rules and eventually becomes used to them? Even if that means even worse tantrums than usual, while she gets used to them, her older brother is placid and well behaved, and that is why this is all new to me. I had rules for him, but he wasn't crying and tantruming, so of course it was much easier to have rules.
Oh, there's so much here. I think, first of all, like when I saw, you know, when you were reading there about she's 3.5 now and she's doing this for about a year, I was thinking that must coincide with starting preschool. And I wonder, is there a correlation there? And then when this mom is saying, look, she does actually get on very well at preschool. Sometimes what we can see is that children, when they're in preschool, are getting lots of opportunity to try out new things, to be independent, to have to do things for themselves. And if that's not happening at home as well, then there's two different ways that she's being related to. One is, come on, you can do it, lots of responsibility. And the other is, be my baby, you can be a baby, I'll do everything for you. And I'm doing a lot to placate you because I'm trying to avoid those tantrums. And that avoidance is twofold. I mean, of course, you know, I think the overt motivation to avoid the tantrum is you don't want your little one upset. Like, that makes complete sense. Who does? But at the same time, try to step back and be a little honest. How hard do you find these tantrums? You know, I think for parents who really find that kind of demonstrative anger, thrashing about very difficult, or the use of rules as a word keeps jumping out to me. If you're a little bit averse to that yourself, this stage of parenting is extremely difficult, because I'm going to ask you to take that word rules and throw it out the window. Okay, this isn't about rules. This is about boundaries and limit setting. And you have to shift your thinking away from boundaries being something that are inhibiting and restrictive, when actually they're reassuring, you know. Like, now look at, thank you for those boundaries, said no child ever, particularly not a toddler. They're not going to thank you for this, but how she lives is how you know it's working, because it is about a felt safety and feeling emotionally reassured. Gentle yet firm boundaries. And don't confuse that with rigidity. Rules can be more rigid. Boundaries are about being adaptable and flexible to the situation at hand and what's needed, but conveying in that doing rather than saying way that there is a safe, trusted adult in charge who's going to stop you and this situation from getting out of control. You can relax. And that allows children to emotionally exhale and say, okay, you take care of the big stuff and I'll worry about the stuff in the middle and in between this, which is about providing this parental scaffolding in which your child feels safe and they can express themselves and explore the world within your scaffolding. And I think that might be something that's just getting a little confused or missed here. So now look, at you're dead right. You know, you say here, look, will there be even worse tantrums than usual while she gets used? It's not like you can say, okay, I'm changing how we do things, and your child goes, high five, great, that's worked straight away. You will go through a stage of resistance. The important thing is that you understand with these boundaries, at 3.5, it is her job to push and rail against them, and it is your job to hold them in place. So if she does protest, she's doing is exactly her developmental job. Oh, I see your boundaries. Now let me test them. Oh, would you look at that? They can withstand me. Now I don't need to test them anymore. So she does have to go through that process. It's about gentle yet firm, and that's what works. Now, I do also think that, you know, this piece about being a baby and if your child does this, you know, go with it. In large part, yes, that's true. But, you know, at the same time, you want to hear what that's about. Often children, especially when they're making a transition, like going from home into preschool, you might see some behavioral or emotional regression whereby they go back to an earlier stage of development or emotional expression, and we meet them where they're at and we kind of top that up for them so that they revert to where they should be developmentally. If she's getting stuck in that baby thing, what may be happening is she's learning that is her way of connecting with you is as a baby. And to that end, I'm going to ask you to give her some more responsibilities. And what I mean by that is setting her chores. And I know she's 3.5, but at 3.5, she's well able to do a few little chores for you. She can bring her plate and her spoon from the table over to the kitchen counter when she's done. She can straighten her duvet on her bed. She can put her jammies under the pillow every morning. She can gather up her laundry and put it into the laundry basket. She can do things that allow you to focus on praising her efforts over outcome and saying, oh, that was such a great help. I love that you remembered how to do this. You did a great job, you know, straightening your duvet this morning, which means that your praise can be very specific. And we know that praise that is very specific is the type of praise that affects self-esteem. And all of that will combine to help her assume this 3.5-year-old role and to kind of grow up. Seems like a weird thing to say about a toddler, but, you know, emotionally, just developmentally grow up in line with where her chronological age is. So I would definitely increase some responsibilities and set some chores. And, you know, don't make them sound like, here's your chores, it's drudgery. But make it sound like, look, you can do so many things, now you're going to do this as well. And because she's getting on well in her play school, why don't you talk to them and explore a bit with them what they're doing and how they're experiencing her and her reactions, and see what of their boundaries and expectations you can mirror and replicate at home so she's getting a more consistent response.
Yeah. And I suppose the you know, reverting back to being a baby, she's only 3.5, but already she's seeing changes in her own life that are massive for her.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I just think we underestimate how much change goes on for really little kids. And they go through so much development. You know, by the age of 2, they've gone through codependency and attachment cycle 1 and object to people permanence and attachment cycle 2. And that's the ripe old age of 2. So their brains are on fire with soaking up, learning and working out the world and understanding how they have to relate to others outside of them and the world around them. That's so difficult, and they're so young. And making that transition then from being your baby to being your preschooler, that's a massive transition, and they need that little bit of help and encouragement. So it's like we're their emotional cheerleaders. You know, you can do this. And we want to stretch them a little, not a lot, but a little outside of their comfort zone so that they can take healthy risk-taking behavior and take a chance on something and see, does it work out, and see all that they're capable of. That's a process. But it also takes us growing our parenting up in line with their growing up. And it starts at this stage.
And they're going to have wobblies.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Tag team it. I have a gorgeous, feisty 18-month-old toddler. We've recently had a change beyond our control to have her childcare arrangement. So her childminder is now minding her in our home. There are benefits to her being in our home environment, no doubt. But there are challenges too, namely that I'm currently on maternity leave with our second baby, who I am breastfeeding. So I need time to nurse her and therefore someone to keep the toddler occupied. Our toddler understandably becomes very clingy when the childminder arrives at our home. This puts the childminder in a difficult position as she's trying to mind her while I'm there. I first tried the two of us being present, the childminder and me, but she, the toddler, was very clingy and cranky throughout the day. So then I tried hiding in my room for the day, and I could hear that after 9 minutes of crying, she was much more content and happy for the day. So I've been slipping away while she is distracted in the morning and trying to stay upstairs out of the way during the day. I hate the idea that she would feel confused, disoriented and upset by not knowing whether I'm coming or going during the day. But I also understand that saying a clear goodbye is important. I'm not sure whether to stay out of the way as much as possible or establish the habit of coming and going throughout the day. But I'm willing to do whatever is in her best interest and would greatly appreciate your guidance.
Oh, yeah. I mean, gosh, the poor little thing, like she's 18 months. And actually, there's been two big changes in her life already and in and around the same time. You know, she's had a change in childcare arrangements and also she's had a new sibling. So that's really significant. And look, the short answer for me is I'm not a fan of parents just slipping away and knowing, and we do know it will ultimately be okay. It's not like you're leaving her with wolves. You're leaving her with a safe, trusted adult, but she doesn't get to have that closure and goodbye from you. So I think you do need to locate yourself somewhere for her and, you know, be very clear about stating, I need to go upstairs and that's where I'm going to be, so that she can tolerate your being there but gone, and focus on that first before you do this kind of coming and going thing that you're suggesting. You know, is it better to come and go? I would say no. Let's build up her tolerance that you're there but I don't have access to you before she could tolerate you coming and going. The other thing I would do is make the childminder coming in like an exciting and playful thing, you know, call it her special playtime, have a nice snack ready for when the minder arrives. So she's anticipating the minder coming and going, we're going to have our snack. And then I think I'd also structure a little, now not hugely, but structure a little plan with the minder about what they're going to do. So have something like because at the age she's at, a sensory activity set up so that your daughter is excited about the minder coming. Because as soon as she comes, we're going to get to make this Play-Doh or do this water play or make mud pies or whatever it is you're doing. You know, we're going to get to do this. So I'm actually looking forward to my minder coming. And therefore, it's easier for me to say, yeah, you go do what you need to do because I have all this fun stuff here with whoever is coming in. And I think that's going to help if you structure it that way. And I think you're right. At 18 months, just hold in mind that people permanence is still developing and fragile. It's really between that 12 to 18 month age that our children do move from object to people permanence. So, you know, like if you're waving the teddy in front of their face and then you quickly hide it behind your back. And for them, it's like amazing. Teddy has disappeared. And then you bring him back and they're like, what? But through repetition of that, they're like, it's not that amazing. Teddy's behind your back. I get it. He still exists when I don't see him. And then they move that to people, parents, important people in their life, so that you can go and I can hold in mind that you still exist even when we're not together. Now, a whole lot's been going on in the last few months for little people, like, you know, parents are suddenly around more, never mind the maternity aspect of this, but in general, parents are around more, but I'm supposed to be able to hold in mind that you're here, but you're on a Zoom call or you're working, so I should pretend you're not here. And that's very difficult for little kids to do. And you are there. And more than that, the little one is saying, I don't get to have you, but you get to go upstairs with the baby. How is that fair? So I think that is hard for her, and to be empathic about that, it is very hard to see. So the baby gets to have you, but I have to stay away from you. No, thanks. I don't like that at all. So of course she's going to react. But again, I think investing in the playtime with the minder, even having a little special play kit in a box that's just for them when they're together, will make that more exciting and appealing for her.
It's not much fun for a mom having to hide up in the room with the baby.
No, I'm hoping she has a stash of snacks and reading material and a charger and water and tea. Like, no. And I mean, the whole point of having the minder is to make your life easier during this time. Mm. And it just sounds a bit stressful. But I think the stress, when I heard you reading this through, what jumped out for me was the stress is that 9 minutes of crying. The fact that this mom knows it's 9 minutes means you've timed.
Yeah, of course.
She's timed it. And that's really hard. And, you know, I can just even share my own experience because I work from home quite a bit, even pre-COVID, and have had child minding in the house and know what it's like to be saying, yeah, I'm going to work, but you know, I'm upstairs, and having a little one shouting at the end of the stairs, going, but I know you're there. I know you're there. And it takes calm, consistency, and actually being able to push through that to establish it. So it might just be worth doing a little tour with her and say, so this is where I'm going to be. And I have little jobs to do. Don't make it sound too fun. I have little jobs to do while you're playing. So you get to play and I have to do jobs. And you just do a little let her locate you. Here's where I'm going to be when I'm not with you. And when we come back downstairs, we get to do story time or block building or whatever it is you're going to do with her, so that you're structuring the day out. But I think just be patient with this too. 18 months is very young to try and grapple with all of that. And really for her, she's minimizing it down to, I want to be upstairs with you and the baby.
Yeah, it is a tough one. We do have to take a commercial break. You are listening to the Moncrief Show on News Talk. After that, a dreamy nine-year-old. 53106 is our text number. That will cost you 30 cents. You are listening to the Moncrief Show on News Talk. Just referring back to some of the questions that that Joanna Fortune has been answering already. One was about a three-year-old who's going through a bit of a difficult phase. Nora says, it just sounds like that woman needs to be a little bit firmer. I'm not saying kids need a clip around the ear or anything, but godparents these days are way too soft. Is that true sometimes that we perhaps give them, do you think, a bit, you know, we're a bit too easy on them?
Yeah, I don't think, you know, I totally get the word soft, but I think it comes from somewhere else in my experience. I think we did at some point lose the run of ourselves in terms of choice and the concept, thinking that we should give kids loads of choice over what they do and how they do it. And children should have choice, but within parental boundaries. You know, so you would never say to a child, what do you want to drink with your dinner? Because they're going to say something like Coke, and then you're fighting over something that was never an option. But if you were to say something like, would you like milk or water? They get to make a choice that is within your boundaries. And that's where I think it got a bit confused, that children got, you know, too much open-ended choice without the boundary piece. And I think we do often confuse boundaries with rules and feel like they're a bad thing, when actually they're an absolutely vital thing for children growing up. It's terrifying to grow up without boundaries.
Yeah, indeed. I often use one. Would you want to walk to bed or shall I carry you?
Perfect example.
Yes, she always says carry, which has me back wrecked.
Yeah. That's a good point. You should always make the choice of something that you're happy with.
Yes. On the second question about trying to work from home while having a childcare there, Siobhan says, I've been really struggling with that homework boundary since lockdown. I just can't convince my kids that the conceit of the office is different to the house. Yeah, it is a very tricky one to sell them, as we've seen from those numerous videos when the kids are bursting in. Anyway, next question is this. My son is 9. He's a great kid, smart fellow, fully bilingual in a European language and English. From a young age, he was obviously more interested in seeking out the fun in life than in feeling down or sad about things. He's an only child of two somewhat older parents and is very sociable among all age groups. My concern is that he's now in fourth class in a group of 33 kids. The school had managed to split that into two groups up and until second class, but since last year, with staff shortages and rising intake, they say they couldn't afford to have them split any longer. So this is his second year in such a large class, and it seems to be having a serious effect on his ability to focus and concentrate in class time. He's always been a bit dreamy at home as well, but I'm concerned that if he doesn't get to grips with learning how to learn at his age, it will only get more difficult for him from now on. He's among the top of his class across most subjects, but he makes lots of mistakes through sloppiness, not finishing his task, or sometimes even doing the wrong task. His teacher is concerned that he's not showing what he's capable of, that he's away with the fairies most of the time. If a task has been set, doesn't come with written instructions, which he can easily follow himself, he seems to miss key elements and ends up not completing or incorrectly completing the task. This can be as simple as writing something or taking a book from one teacher to another. The teacher understands my frustrations with the class size, but is confident that this isn't a contributing factor. He reckons my son doesn't take responsibility to listen or tune in. I can agree with the second part, but completely disagree on the first part of the sentence. And if I had the wherewithal, I'd find a school with a smaller class size and move home to make it work. It's breaking my heart to think that he's lost in that sea of 33 kids, all of whom need more attention in their own ways than the teacher can possibly provide. I've been encouraging my son to see the next few months as a bit of an adventure, a challenge to try and to learn how to focus. And I've suggested he break it down in steps, such as active listening when the teacher is saying something that's aimed at him or his group, thinking through what was said, asked of him, and asking for clarification if needed, and then planning how we might get it done. Have you any suggestions of how we can help my son get this right?
Oh my goodness, all I keep thinking listening is, God, we really need to give our schools more resources. That's, I can't, for the kids, for parents and for teachers, that's just so challenging, because the line that jumped out there is like, all of these children have more needs than one adult in 33 kids could possibly provide. So I think, you know, I just wanted to start with kind of empathizing with that. I don't think that's easy for anyone involved. I'm also going to throw a little curveball here, which teachers and parents mightn't love me saying, but I love the away with the fairies thing. Couldn't we all do with being away with the fairies a little bit more of the time? Not most of the time, but a little bit more of the time. Because I think certainly my inference from away with the fairies is daydreaming and, you know, letting his thoughts drift away. And daydreaming is healthy. In fact, it's the brain's preferred resting mode. It's free-floating state of attention. It allows us to process what's going on, come up with new ideas. It brings about creativity, desire. I think it's great. And in our constantly switched on world, we could all do with a bit more free-floating state of attention that daydreaming allows. So I'm not against daydreaming, but I do acknowledge in this context that you might be listening going, that's fine, Joanna, but he still has to get through his workload. And he does, but he's 9. OK, so learning is, you know, there are many ways to learn. When he's daydreaming, he's learning. When he's playing, he's learning. When he's creating, he's learning. And when he's in school, sitting and task completing, he's learning. But they are different types of learning. So this isn't all about the learning how to learn in a classroom environment. That I really think we need to embrace more holistic types of learning for our kids to thrive within. I think what you could do, because he sounds like most things are going mostly well here, this sounds like a kid who's doing mostly well most of the time, but increase some responsibility at home that you don't supervise, because I do hear, like, as a parent, you're giving him lots of direction, lots of structure. Here's how to do it. Here's how to do it. Do it this way. Why don't you do it this way? And actually, we have to, as parents, avoid getting pulled into that kind of fixed agenda with our kids, where we, you know, here's your problem, and by the way, here's your answer, now just do it, because then it doesn't come of them and they haven't integrated it. But if you can increase the responsibility, and I'm thinking you could get a fish that he is responsible for taking care of, like a goldfish, or, do you know what, a plant is fine. If you're going, I do not want the responsibility of a fish, get a plant. He is responsible for watering it, taking care of it. And you know what, if he overwaters it and it dies, that's a learning experience and a consequence. And that's why maybe it's safer than the fish. And if he underwaters it, you know, you don't go out and sneak watering it for him. If he's taking too much care of it, you don't kind of drain out the extra water. Let what happens so that he learns from it, and he learns that he has to take responsibility for things, and it's something he has to do every day. I really like what you're saying here at the end, that you've made all of these suggestions about breaking it down into steps. I'm curious, though, how you presented this to him, and if you gave it to him verbally as a list of instructions. I'm sorry to tell you, that probably didn't go in. Because when we do that, when we give our kids a barrage of verbal instructions, they're listening for the first 10 words or so, and then their attention has gone. And then we say, do you know what I mean? Or did you hear me? Or are you listening? And every child on the planet knows the answer to that question is, oh yeah, definitely. But they definitely have not been. So you're going to see, like, I thought he got it and it didn't work. So can you go back and do that, but make it a super playful way of doing it? So write down scenarios like that involve, say, 3 steps. You know, in my day tomorrow, I have to get to the shop, I have to, you know, pick up a book, and I have to drop something off at the post office. Make it into a little story that has 3 clear instructions. And he has to take one out and he has to break that down into steps. What would he do first? What has to happen next? And you can put an extra challenge in there by setting a timer and saying, and you have to get it done within this time. How would you do it? So you're engaging the solution-focused thinking, but in a more playful way, because it's on a scenario outside of himself, but he's still learning the skills on how to do that. You could also do a little bit of conversational analysis with him, whereby you say, look, I'm going to tell you a story. It's going to be the same story. I'll tell it to you 3 ways. So it should be short but meaningful, something you have a strong feeling about. And you're going to ask him to tell you how you felt about that story by first telling he looks at your facial muscles, Second telling, he looks at your body language. And the third telling, it's about what you said and how you said it. Because you're trying to help him understand when the teacher's talking to him. He has to give that full attention of not just what the teacher's saying, but recognizing the nonverbal cues that his teacher getting a bit frustrated. Am I maybe in trouble here? Is there something time sensitive and there's a sense of urgency about it? He might need a playful way of picking up those nonverbal cues around what's happening. But outside of that, because you know, there's a lot of focus on learning and academia and, you know, how smart and clever he is and all of that. I want to go back to that opening line about how he's always been interested in seeking out the fun in life. How fabulous is that? So make sure you ensure space and opportunity for fun, absolute silliness, like embrace the silliness and make sure he has lots of time for that and creativity in his day that isn't about sitting and doing homework and task completing, but gives him a space to emotionally exhale and embrace his kind of dreamy, creative side, because I think that's a really important part to him. And you don't want him to lose that because he has to overfocus on this other stuff. It's about balance.
Yeah. Few comments on that now. Mick says the kid sounds very smart, so I don't know how much it has to do with class size. Kids like that are often just bored because they're a bit ahead of the lesson. As he gets to secondary school, this problem will be alleviated by the harder subjects like honours maths. The fact that he's bilingual already would, I imagine, put him ahead of his classmates, would it?
Oh, and look, you know, that's the other side when I mentioned about schools needing resources, that the class has to move at a pace that suits everybody. And of course, that means it doesn't suit everybody, because if you're a kid who's like, yeah, I got that like 20 minutes ago, but we're still talking about it, I'm not engaged with you. I'm thinking of lots of other things. And maybe the other things I'm thinking about are at the moment, frankly, more interesting than what we're talking about. So then I will look like I've detached. The only thing on that is the teacher is saying he's not reaching his potential because of this. And, you know, that he's not showing what he's capable of. So there is a recognition here that this is a kid with lots of potential. But I still think kids with lots of potential, they need an outlet for that potential that is beyond a classroom. So making sure he has access to extracurricular activities that are fun, like that don't have a, you know, earn your belts or earn your badges, but just do it for fun. I think that would be really important for him, because it's not about his capability. It's about an outlet for having silliness and creativity.
Well, yeah, but though the parent does say he's among the top in his class, so it's not a severe problem. And he's nine. You know, he's not like doing the Leaving Cert next week.
And I think we can forget at that age how important playfulness and silliness and all of that is. It's actually vital to their development. Like he's in that developmental process of when their brains are changing and he's starting to shift his focus towards his peers and what brings him pleasure and what suits him. So I just think make sure there's space for him to be supported in that. I think it can be frustrating for us parents too, that we know our kids are in these crowded classrooms and that everybody's under pressure. And, you know, just be careful that we don't pass that between us like a hot potato of tension, parent to teacher, teacher to parent, parent to teacher. But let's look in a way that we can work collaboratively, because, you know, teachers are so important in terms of emotional relationships in the lives of students. And we do need to uphold and nurture that as well.
Because we have been talking about a child who's smart but a bit dreamy, so that's pretty much all of them. About the 9-year-old, I thought she was describing my 14-year-old. Might he have dyspraxia or dysgraphia? Slow at processing but very smart. Now, I assume that she's asking about the 14-year-old, not the...
If you have any question about anything like dysgraphia or dyscalculia or dyslexia or dyspraxia, I mean, absolutely, those are developmental conditions and they should be properly assessed. And, you know, make sure you reach out to your GP for a referral to Child and Adolescent Mental Health Services, where you could get that assessed with an occupational therapist and psychologist there. I think that's really important. There's nothing in this letter, if that person is wondering about this child, there's nothing really in here that would consistently point to that. But I'm super aware that we get a snapshot, you know, that people write into us. And if it is something that was ever flagged, then I would always say follow that up. Definitely follow. If only to rule it out, follow it up.
And Gemma says, come on. I was in a class of 65.
Oh, my God.
Where? Were you in Borstal when you were younger? Awful for wee kids who were hammered for failure, but okay for bright kids like that lad. Now, this is, I suppose, the contentious part. No research that large classes are bad for kids. Very tough on teachers, though. Is there no research that large classes are bad for kids?
Well, I mean, it might be about consistency in research. There's research out there that looks at class sizes and outcomes, and there are many variables. I think that might be what she is referring to, that it's not as simple as reducing it to class size alone, because there will be kids who manage that and there will be kids who don't, and that's owing to outside variables that might be about family, socioeconomic variables, what input from parents, other developmental considerations. There could be truckloads of other variables that would have to be factored in. But I think, if a teacher is stressed, if we acknowledge a crowded classroom is stressful for a teacher, then we would have to acknowledge that's an impact on students.
Finally, just referring back to what Joanna was saying about, they only concentrate for so long when you're talking to them. One texter says, my son always said, you've said 7 words, Mum. After that, it's noise. Joanna Fortune.
He's so right.
Thanks a million for talking to us today. Joanna Fortune there. You are listening to the Moncrief Show on News Talk. We're going to take a break after that. Is religion important?
Moncrief on News Talk.
With the Dacia range. Drive away today with no payments for the first 3 months.